I tell the honest stories behind the facade of women's issues, alternative health, and life in general. As a retired midwife, I no longer have a horse in the race of healthcare. Covering birth, death, parenting, and the female experience, whatever that is and however that looks. If it happened to someone who identifies as female, it's fair game. Welcome to my show, Midwife Talks. I'm Lindy Casey, retired midwife. I discuss anything and everything, but mostly women's health, crunchy stuff, and birth stories. Pardon the sound of children in the background. On the heels of the Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial, we're jumping into the deep stuff with this episode. Today I have a guest. Christina is a survivor of domestic assault. She's been out of that relationship for many years, but remembers it clearly. Thanks for coming on to talk about your experiences with domestic violence. Would you give us some idea of what you've been through, but don't share anything that makes you feel uncomfortable or vulnerable? So how long ago were you the victim of domestic abuse?
It has been about 29 years ago when it began, and about 27 years ago since I was no longer in that relationship.
So was it physical abuse, mental abuse?
So it was everything that Amber Heard has referenced that she experienced at the hand of Johnny Depp. Even so much as some of the experiences that she has described were like taking a page from my own diary or my own experiences, which was, I think, the initial trigger of watching the trial.
How old were you when that abuse took place?
It started when I was 16.
And was it physical abuse?
It started out, which was interesting, and again, I don't mean to keep bringing up, though this is part of what we're talking about here, but it's interesting that it started out just as Amber Heard described as the first time that she was abused by Johnny. So it started out as a slap, not hard enough to make a mark on the face, enough to get my attention, and it was over a sandwich. I asked what was on a sandwich, and I was slapped, and the food was thrown away. And then I was made to feel like it was my fault, that if I had not questioned it, I would not have been slapped and I would have eaten.
So I think it's interesting that you totally can relate to that first incident that she says, and yet you didn't believe her.
I don't know how to describe it. It just is something, the look on her face, the way she stated it, the details, there was just something. It's a gut feeling. I don't know how else to
okay.
say it. It was just a gut feeling.
Okay, I believe you. So were you ever injured so hard that you had bruises?
Yes. I think the first time that I was injured so badly that I had bruises, I was left. We had been driving on the freeway. And again, I said something that was disagreeable, and there were other people in the vehicle, someone else that was driving, we were in a van, and I was punched repeatedly and grabbed by the neck, and I thought I was gonna be thrown out the door. I thought he was gonna open the door and throw me out on the freeway. And instead they pulled over and they pushed me out of the van, and I wasn't very far from an off-ramp, but I walked off the freeway and down an off-ramp to a gas station, and I didn't have any money, and the cashier called my mom.
So what injuries did you have?
That time, I know I had bruises on my arms and strangle marks on my neck. My nose was not broken that time, but I did have black eyes, and I had scratches on my head.
So how many more times did it happen after that?
Too many to remember, but because there were just, you know, little tiny ones that you just don't, I mean, you just don't even count, because it's like dodging a bullet. It's like, oh, it was just a grab of the wrist or a slap or, you know, an insult in the ear. But as far as like hardcore hitting or beatings, there were two more really major ones before I thought I truly was going to die. So there was actually four more major ones after that, but two more before it went to the point where I thought, and other people thought, I was going to die. And then the final one that made me leave the situation. I think the next major one was actually, well, the first time it was in front of family members of mine, a toddler bed was thrown at my head and knocked me out. And when I went to the emergency room, and I can't remember if they did an x-ray that time or not, but I think they did an x-ray because we thought I had a concussion or whatever they did. And I had healed like fractures, which the skull fractures are very interesting, that the way they determine how old they are is not as we would normally think. And so it can be within like a day or two, and then it's within like a couple of days, and then anything that's over a week old, it's harder to determine if it's like a week old, a month old, a year old, because your body just has a remarkable way of healing. But I had healed or partially healed skull fractures.
And how old were you at that time?
I was 17.
Why do you think the hospital didn't turn this situation into Child Protective Services?
Well, I was a teen mom with a 2-year-old, and I think that this was in 93, and it began in late 92 and then went into late 93. I think that the bias or the thought process was, well, I did have one person even say to me, you're almost 18, you know, you're...
Well, I know from my own experience that in the 1980s, the law was that if a police officer saw injury to somebody, they were required to arrest the injuring party. They were required. And so, and it's always been that doctors and teachers have to report abuse. They have to. So I think it's interesting that you were treated that way. And I wonder if that was because it was a small town or if it was some bias on their part because you were a teen mom.
I always assumed it was some bias. And so that was part of what made me think that if I reported it, it wasn't going to go anywhere, because as you pointed out, you know, I had medical professionals that did see. The police were called that time. An ambulance was called. You know, I mean, there was enough documentation, and he was released. He was arrested, and then he was released.
So why did you stay with him?
That's part of the abuse, is, and now we have the term gaslighting, and maybe it was around back then, but I had not heard it until sometime in the last 10 years. But the term that I would have used, or that I did use, was manipulation and brainwashing, because that's part of the abuse and what that type of person seeks out, is somebody that they can easily do that to. So in my case, I was a little bit of an introvert, and I had what you would now call probably daddy issues, and I had a sense of wanting to belong, and this man, you know, was able to see that. And he was a professional, criminal, intimate, violent abuser. I was not the first and I was not the last. He made a, you know, this is just what he did. With the what we now know as gaslighting, you know, you're told that no one else is going to want you, or, you know, there's something wrong with you, or it's you made them do it. You know, that's a huge one. I hit you, but, or I slapped you, but, or I didn't mean to do that, but you pushed me to do it. You made me do it. You know, you're made to feel like that. And so, you know, it begins to kind of become almost normalized in your head, or you become conditioned to it and you no longer see it. Those, I think deep down, you know, you always know, but, you know, you just kind of, you make excuses as to why it's okay and no one else is going to want you. You know, obviously there's something so completely wrong with you that you make this person lose absolute control, that they beat you, and yet they want to stay with you. So who else is going to want to stay with you when you're such a horrible person like that? And that, again, is part of the abuse.
So what was the inciting event that made you leave?
You know, it's just, it's so interesting because, again, as I say these things, you'll see what the correlation between my story and Johnny Depp's story is. So I was away from my family. I was in a different state. I had just found out that I was pregnant by my abuser, and he had decided that I was plotting against him to get him in trouble with the landlord and his boss, and I don't even know what all. He just decided that I was plotting against him. And I went to bed, and I woke up the next day, and he had taken a Sharpie and written all over the walls in the living room horrible, horrible things about me, and it just really scared me. It scared me more than, which isn't interesting, but it scared me more than other things that he had done had scared me. And he had not left for work yet, and I'm not really sure, this is like the one time that my memory gets foggy, I'm not really sure what I said, but I know I said something. Or maybe I didn't say something and I was ignoring him, but as I was walking by him, it was whatever the situation was, whether I didn't say something or I was ignoring him, but it set him off and he grabbed me and just started hitting me. And I thought, he's going to kill me. And I'm pregnant and I'm away from my family. I think that that finally was the... I think that finally was just the thing that made me decide, if I stay, I'm going to die. And he eventually left for work, and I called the one person that I had a phone number for, which he worked as a private contractor painter, and it was somebody that he had worked with, and I had his phone number. I walked to the payphone and I called him. And I asked him if he would help me. And I don't even know where the strength came from. And he did. He helped me get a plane ticket and sent me home.
So it really was hard for you to watch the trial, but I know, because we've talked about it, that you watched it all the time.
I did. It was kind of hard to not watch it, and I'm not really sure why I was able to do so, because normally I avoid anything having to do with intimate partner violence or SA with anything in the media or even, just reading books or watching movies about it. I really have a hard time doing so. I think that it was a combination of following the story 6 years ago when it first played out, and also being in my 40s and remembering Johnny Depp back in the day on 21 Jump Street, and that was my first introduction to him. And so watching him for the last 30 some odd years as an actor, that all of it really just kind of hit home, or I felt like I had an intimate, like inside story or inside, you know, chair at the table with it, or I don't know.
So, because of your own unique experience, it seems like you would have been more sympathetic to Amber Heard.
That, I think, was one of my struggles, was listening to her story 6 years ago, and then a couple of years ago with the UK trial, which I did not really watch a whole lot of, and I'm not sure what the circumstances were as to why I didn't, but I didn't watch a whole lot of that. But then when I heard that the court case was finally coming up with this recently in Virginia, I decided that I was going to watch a little bit of it on YouTube. And then I found myself absolutely drawn into it, not being sympathetic towards Amber, and not being sympathetic to Amber necessarily, and not watching it as so many other people did, because it was a high profile case of two well-known Hollywood actors. But I found myself wanting to follow it or being riveted by it because her account of what happened was so outrageous and just continued to grow each time she opened her mouth, that it was almost like being, well, I used the term triggered several times when talking to people about it, but it was almost like being victimized all over again. And for someone who has been in that position, oftentimes it's hard to not watch or see things or to walk away.
So was your sense of victimization because you could relate to what she'd been through, or was it because you felt like what she was relating, her experience wasn't genuine?
It felt like it was not genuine, and the level of abuse that she was describing was not, she had too many things that she was describing that were going on, and it just did not seem like it was possible for, first, her to be going through that and having no outward signs of it, either physical or in the way that she was emotionally, or you know, in anything. She just didn't have any outward signs. And I know that that's not always, you know, that doesn't always happen. You know, victims of abuse hide it very well. But there was this quality about the way she spoke that was just
disingenuous. So when you were watching it and you said you felt like you were triggered, did it bring you back to your own experiences of abuse?
In some ways, it brought me back to my own experiences of abuse, but it was also watching somebody be abused, because there was a quality in the words that she was using, the expressions that she was using, and her demeanor that were abusive. And I don't really know how to explain it other than that. Someone who has been in that situation will understand what I'm trying to say or what I'm trying to convey. But even during the trial, what she was doing was abuse. It was completely horrible to watch her do that to Johnny Depp, and it was extremely triggering for me, because it was like she was taking stories that she had read of other people's, you know, accounts of their own physical or sexual assaults. And in one instance, her stylist even said that Amber Heard stole her abuse story. But it was like she took all of these stories and they were all jumbled up and they did not fit together. And she was trying to fit it together in a cohesive way that it was just...
Considering how you feel about this, do you think that there will be people who genuinely have been abused who will feel like they can't come forward after watching this trial?
I don't think that anything that happened in this trial is going to stop people that have been abused come forward or change the decision for the negative to come forward. I can see that it's going to open up avenues for people to feel more comfortable in coming forward. But some of the points that her attorneys made in their closing argument about that this was going to stop victims from coming forward, they're completely wrong. It's not the trial or this that would have caused them to not want to come forward. Those fears or... It's interesting because when we're just sitting and talking, it just flows. And when I'm trying to think of it, I cannot even think of a word. I don't think it's going to cause people to not want to come forward any more than they were already uncertain about coming forward. I think that it's going to make men and even women or transgendered people feel more comfortable in coming forward. Those that normally would not want to admit to abuse, I think they're going to feel more like they have a voice now that a very famous, very vivacious, very handsome, very sexually attractive man has stood up and said, I was abused, and he won a very publicized case. And I think that that's going to cause more good than harm.
Considering that the way this all came about was that Amber Heard published an op-ed in a popular source of media, and then it just snowballed from there. There are some people who think that that is a viable way to report sexual assault or intimate partner violence because the police don't take it seriously. How do you feel about that way of exposing the abuser? Is that a valid way to expose the abuser? Do you feel like the police are... Do you feel like the police are a viable option for reporting abuse? Do you feel like, there's a whole bunch of things that go into that about how this all came about and how could it be different? How could it have been different?
Well, I think that just as we see anytime there's heat turned up under anything like this, I believe that the police are going to be a little bit more diligent when somebody reports. I think that schools or psychiatrists or parents or, church advisors, I think people are going to be a little bit more careful in not brushing off when somebody says, hey, this doesn't feel right. This happened. This, made me feel uncomfortable. Because right now, there's so much heat on the system to take this seriously, and maybe it'll kind of cool down and we'll go back to the way things have been up to this point, where depending on who you are and where you live and what you're reporting and who you're reporting to, the seriousness of how you are taken can be changed so easily.
In exposing an assault and going to a media source rather than the police, and then it making its way through the courts to get to the point that this trial got to, my takeaway is that if you're going to go that route, you had better make sure that everything you said was absolutely true, accurate, and verifiable. Sometimes people say that they don't want to go to the police after some kind of assault because they feel like they won't be taken seriously, or they'll be subjected to questions about their own activities. Is that something that you considered, or did you ever consider going to the police? Because you didn't go to the police. So Is that a reason why you wouldn't have gone to the police? Did you consider that?
I did consider that, and I did talk to someone about it. And I guess, you know, looking back now, almost 30 years later, that the advice or the information that I was given probably was just as harmful to a victim as being in the domestic.
So are you saying that you think that the advice you were given by this other person, whoever that was abuse in and of itself?
By the standards that we use now, yes. So given the relationship status that I had with the person that, with the intimate partner violence, and given the fact that I was a teen mom, and given the fact that I had not reported anything up to that point, I was told that the chances of being believed or taken seriously or anything coming of it were very slim. Because, and there's a word that I want and I cannot
that's
think
that. The way that's the way it worked back then.
That's the way it worked back then. I know in some areas people still say that's what they're afraid of, how it's going to work now. And I don't know if they're going off of just old information, but, or maybe there are still people that are operating in that manner. We don't.
Okay, so do you think if Amber Heard had gone to the police and said, my husband has done these things to me, with the evidence that she presented at trial, do you think the police would have proceeded with some sort of action against Johnny Depp?
So take away their status. So if they were just, the police didn't know who they were just a plain old married couple, given the evidence and the severity of the abuse that she is reporting that was done to her, and the fact that she is a female and he is a male, I absolutely believe that they would have taken her seriously, that they would have encouraged her to press charges, and that this would have played out much differently. And I think on some level she knew that, or maybe became aware of that, or maybe somebody told her that. And clearly, this was not a genuine reporting of abuse. You know, this was a story, this was a game, or this was, I don't really know what her motive was, but there was no, I believe that if there was truly abuse going on, for as articulate as she can be during interviews, and as carefully as she documented all of Johnny Depp's drunken and drugged activities, that if she was truly being abused in the manner that she said she was, she would have had documentation or a very good case to file charges.
So that's a good point. Would you advise people, and I'm not going to say women, because obviously from this case we know that men are abused too. Not that we didn't know that before, but certainly it's put a floodlight on it. Would you say that documenting your abuse is the way to go, with photographs or telling other people, or I don't know, what do you think?
I think it can go either way, because obviously she, in this case, she was telling people, she was creating a documentation of, you know, to prove what she was telling people.
So she was documenting what she was documenting. Obviously, her documentation wasn't good enough. So in another situation, if somebody was going to document what they were going through, instead of taking pictures or videos of their drunken husband asleep with melting ice cream, would it have been better for her to take realistic photographs of what damage she says he did to her body? So let's take Johnny Depp and Amber Heard out of this, and let's just go with Mary and John Smith. And Mary Smith is getting wailed on by John, and she doesn't want to have to put up with this anymore, but she's afraid that if she goes to the police, because he's an upstanding citizen, that no one will believe her. So what documentation do you think would be compelling, or would give her the protection of having people think she's a credible victim?
Well, we have an advantage that we didn't have 30 years ago. We have smartphones. And with smartphones, there are so many ways to keep track of everything. So you can keep track of, you know, you can take pictures. You can write notes in it. You can put down, you know, something that only makes sense to you and your calendar to keep track of, you know, dates if you need to, you know, keep track of that. The mapping system in it, the way it marks where you are and, you know, if you need to, it's just to keep track of things.
Just what things would be good documentation that would make a more compelling argument to prove the allegations that an abused person is saying? Photographs.
Photographs. Notes of when things happened. If it was a birthday party, if it was at Christmas time, if, you know, Sam was over, you know, just keeping a record. Details. I mean, saying this, it just feels like that I'm just reinforcing.
Not necessarily. Okay, so let's flip this around. And let's say that Johnny Depp was Joanna and Amber was Andrew. Andrew comes into court and says, Joanna has been beating me. And here's my proof. I have a still photograph that is of a bruise on my face. And I have these stories by my friends. And here's a picture of Joanna drunk. And then Joanna has a finger cut off and also has recordings of Andrew screaming, I hit you, I hit you. I think that when you take the genders of these people out of the equation, you see a different story. And I think that was the thing that a lot of people struggled with, because we are told in this Me Too movement era that we are supposed to believe women no matter what. I don't think we should believe anybody no matter what. We should look at evidence. So the evidence that I'm thinking would be good is photographs of the actual wound, photographs of the actual bruise, not something staged. Don't mess around and try and fix the color or the lighting. If you're going to make videos, you know, a video of somebody throwing a tantrum is one thing, but a video of someone actually doing harm, you know, I don't know that that would be the best thing and the best use of your time. If you're getting hurt, is to take a video of being hurt. I think it would be better to run and then determine how you can document that. But I think that as far as the police goes, going into a police station and saying, here's my diary of when these things happened, they don't care about that. They want to see the evidence that it happened at all, and those dates and times would come in good in a court case, but I don't know that they would come in so good with the police. And I think the police are like the, you know, they're like the army guarding the gates of justice, and somehow you have to get through that army to get to the point where people are going to listen to all the details. Many of you know about my side gigs. I want to take a moment to talk about one of them, a little series of easy reader books I write that I'm super proud of. It's called Kids on C Street, and it's all about some children who lived on one street in one small town in the 1960s. Hashtag Boulder City, Nevada. Every book includes a list of all the words in the story and has been rated to reading level, which is usually first to third grade. I write the books for my great-grandchildren, but your kids can read them too, and I hope you'll enjoy a little wholesome trip down memory lane. You can find them on wishpickle.com or Amazon or Barnes & Noble. Search for Kids on C Street by Lindy Casey. You know, we've kind of gone around in a circle and we've talked a lot about a lot of things, but I guess to come back to how this court case came about, I don't think that is necessarily the appropriate way to handle it, is to go and do an op-ed in a newspaper, because you're going to have to prove your case. So wouldn't it be easier to first prove your case with a legal system, and then you can write your op-ed and be the face of domestic assault? Amber Heard did not prove her case. Johnny Depp did prove his case. So I think that if it's going to have an effect on intimate partner violence reporting, when we're talking about reporting, we're not talking about reporting it to the New York Times.
No.
We're talking about reporting it to the police.
Well, and I think that one thing that she failed to do, and at her disposal, and many people have at their disposal, is medical professionals to go see. And she had plenty of opportunities to go and see those medical professionals, which would not have been, you know, out of the scope of, you know, where they were or what they were doing, because those medical professionals were in and out of their home on a regular basis. And she was not documenting with them. Instead, as you pointed out, she was documenting pictures of Johnny Depp being drunken and you know, or asleep or nodding off. So for the reporting, if somebody is being abused or is having, you know, injuries, and you're seeing a doctor or you're seeing a therapist, document it with them as well, because they're a professional. They can determine a lot of things. And as we know, if it gets to the point of you filing charges, then you have professionals who have seen the
evidence.
The evidence of it.
After watching this trial all the way through, which was difficult to watch, it was difficult even though I didn't necessarily believe a lot of what Amber Heard said, but it was difficult to watch people bare their privacy and their intimate details of their lives, and that was just difficult to watch. But I'm wondering, in your situation, do you, after watching this, do you look back and think, I wish I'd reported this abuse that I went through? Or do you look back and say, boy, am I glad I didn't do it, because I don't think I could have gone through that?
Well, so that's kind of a two-part question or a two-part answer. So first, with Dr. Dawn Hughes, when watching her professional testimony on what she found with Amber Heard, there was a very uncomfortable feeling that I had from listening to her and watching her. I don't even know, again, how to describe it, but it was just as triggering as watching Amber Heard give her testimony. And so I don't know if it was the disingenuous, you know, manner of speech or if it was something else, but I do know that some part of listening to her brought me back to 30 years ago, almost 30 years ago, and the person that I spoke with.
Do you feel like you're thankful you didn't report it back then, or do you wish you had reported it back then after watching this?
I wish I had reported it back then, and I wish I had spoken to people that were
more knowledgeable
about it. You know, I was not the only person that was being victimized back then. There were others. I think that when he eventually went to prison, that if there had been more of us that spoke up, me as well, or pushed to have it be documented, then when he finally went to court, he might have gotten a longer sentence. I think that there would have been more of a sense of I don't want to say the word satisfaction, because then that makes it feel like I don't want to say vindicated.
Vindicated is a good word.
Okay, so I think that maybe I would have felt vindicated. And in my case, he did serve time. He did have to go on the registry, but it was not my story that put him to that point. It was others that came forward that had similar intimate partner violence occur to them.
And it was in another jurisdiction.
And it was in another jurisdiction, yeah.
Which makes a big difference. Because I think that there is a difference between police departments and how they handle those things.
And it was a big jurisdiction. That one was in, Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And so it was huge, and compared to the little town where I was living at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he also was there.
We've talked about how it triggered you watching the trial, mainly because you felt that Amber Heard wasn't being honest, or she seemed in some way disingenuous. So I'm assuming you related more with Johnny Depp than with Amber Heard, with the way he reacted and the way he acted. And there have been people who talked about his behavior in court seemed to be disinterested or not too concerned. But you had a different thing you told me about that. You felt somewhat different.
Well, I felt like it was a coping mechanism for sure, because he's sitting in court with his abuser sitting feet away from him, trying to force him to make eye contact with her, smirking. And I think that she was getting pleasure out of literally re-abusing him in front of hundreds of people, well, millions of people that were watching it. And she was getting, maybe in her mind, away with it. You know, as we all do, we find, and I know I'm not completely answering your question right now, but we all find coping mechanisms for things that are uncomfortable, whether it's somebody that doesn't like dogs and you find a way to be around dogs, or somebody that doesn't like to, you know, heights and you find a way to fly. And so when someone's been abused, you find those ways to get through situations where you feel like you are not safe, or, you know, you're around your abuser, or you're around someone that's, you know, doing something similar. And so I felt like what he was doing was he was in a safe spot with his attorneys. He had comforts. His drawing, which brings him much pleasure, and he's talked about, that's one of the things that he, you know, he uses for coping. If he could have played a guitar, I believe he would have sat there playing a guitar, because that's another thing. So when you saw him smiling or laughing or eating candy or looking disinterested, I don't think that's what it was at all. I think that he was just trying to get through that. And at times you could see his hands were shaking. It makes me want to cry just thinking about, you know, his attorneys putting their hands on his shoulder. You know, that was a horrible situation. It was horrible. And I know there was something else I told you before, and now that I've gone off on this, I don't remember, so you can spark my memory of it.
We've had so many conversations, yeah. I don't know.
But that's how I perceived it. I did not think that he was taking this, or not taking this seriously. I felt like he was taking it extremely seriously and dealing with it in the best way possible. And if, as you've said before, if the roles were reversed, if we were talking about a man sitting in the stand at that moment and a woman who is the abused person sitting at the table in front trying not to make eye contact with her abuser, and he was doing those things to her that Amber Heard was, and almost taunting, I think somebody would have called her out on it in that moment. Well, Camille actually did call Amber out on it for doing that to Johnny. For all of those commenting in the videos afterwards or making TikToks, I believe that if the roles were reversed and it was man as the abuser and the woman as the abused, that people would be calling that out far more.
So something interesting came to my mind as you were saying that. Maybe this is the next phase of the Me Too movement. So everything goes through a natural progression, and first we have Me Too, Me Too, it's women. And maybe now we need to realize that it's not only women, that men are abused. We need to stop, I don't know if it's a word, but genderifying these issues, you know, that this is not a gender issue. This is abuse. And abuse has more to do with power and control than sexual desire or any of those other things. This is all about one person trying to have power and control over another person. And the way they gain that power and control, or at least the semblance of it, a feeling of it, a sense of it, is by hurting them. And there are lots of ways to hurt people. You can hit them, you can beat them, you can scream at them, you can rape them, you can do all kinds of things. But you don't have to be a man or be a woman to be an abuser, and you don't have to be a man or a woman to be abused. So I think if there's anything throughout this whole sordid trial and all this last 6 weeks is sitting in front of the TV for hours on end, what I really feel is this, what I hope that everybody takes home with them, is that men can be abused too, and that the way to handle that is not by going to an op-ed and trying to make yourself the poster child of abuse, but go to the police and have real evidence.
Absolutely. And as you're saying that, yes, men can be abused too, and men can be abused. I'm going to pick on Dr. Dawn Hughes again for a moment. Again, I felt like she was misrepresenting the situation or not taking the situation as serious as it needed to be, because her references of men being abused by other men in intimate relationships, she was missing a point. So men, strong, heterosexual men, can be abused by their 120-pound, whatever it was that they kept referring to, female wife or partner. That can happen.
Well, I'll tell you, in my work as a midwife, many times I've seen situations where, now I never saw anybody hit, actually that's not true, I have seen women hit their partners when they were in labor. I've never seen, just like during a prenatal visit or a postpartum visit, a woman or a man hit the other one. I've never seen that. But I have seen absolutely the most horrible gaslighting and insults, and it's always the woman against the man. And the man always stoically just kind of blank face takes it. And of course he's in a situation where the midwife is there, and you know, maybe there's even other people around, and they don't want to do whatever you would do under those circumstances. So maybe something else happens when there's privacy. But I suspect that something else that happens when there's privacy is a lot worse than what I'm seeing. And it's the woman that's the abuser. That man probably doesn't consider himself abused. He probably just thinks his wife is a bitch. And that's the truth.
Probably.
So I think that there's such a wide spectrum of things and ways people can be hurt by other people. Probably the number one thing you should do right off the bat is the very first time someone acts like a jerk to you, someone isn't kind, or someone isn't protective of you, or someone isn't caring of your feelings, physical safety, whatever those things are, is get the hell out.
I agree.
I know a lot of my listeners are really into doing things the natural way and being self-sufficient. My daughter Christina is the same way and had a dream of owning a farm. While the acreage she pined for didn't pan out, she began to live her dream where she was, on a city lot in the midst of a metro area. She raises chickens for eggs and manure, grows vegetables and fruits, and she preserves what she produces. You can watch what she's up to and learn some things about urban farming on her YouTube channel, Casey Urban Farm. Recently, she's covered dry canning, tomato growing, and different types of raised growing beds. I love that I can walk through her urban oasis every day and see fresh flowers, organic foods, all to the farmy sounds of a rooster crowing. Now you can too. Visit youtube.com/Casey Urban Farm to see what's growing. That's youtube.com/Casey Urban Farm, CaseyUrbanFarm. Were you gonna have nightmares?
No, surprisingly. Well, when the trial first started, it definitely, whatever it was that triggered me, and I keep using that word because, you know, as time goes on, new phrases are coined, or we have things that are politically, you know, however. But when it first started, I definitely was triggered, and I had nightmares, and I had a hard time sleeping. And then I'm not really sure what changed. I think part of it was watching that fucking Don Hughes. I think that pissed me off. That was horrible, and it was, again, triggering. But that pissed me off. There's something about her that I don't know why. I think that she should not be in practice. I think she's doing more harm than good. But I cried happy tears when the verdict was read. And, yeah.
A little bit of justice.
Yep.
That's all for this episode. Thanks for listening. I appreciate every one of you. And remember, if you want to support what I do, then share, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. If you have anything you'd like to add to this subject, you can be part of the conversation. Go to anchor.fm/midwife-talks and click on the message button. That's anchor.fm/midwife-talks. I'll see you in the next episode of Midwife Talks. Links to more information about the topics covered in this show can be found under the podcast tab.